From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nicole Ugrisco with the news on this day in Maine, Monday, April 21st, 2025. Police departments in Monmouth and Winthrop have rescinded their applications to partner with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, citing pushback from local residents. Ari Snyder reports.
Paul Furland, who is the chief of police for both towns, said at a Monmouth Select Board meeting last week that he had hoped to give local officers training on how to handle interactions with undocumented immigrants.
What are the legal boundaries? What do we have the rights to do? Do we have the right to detain them? We don't want to violate anybody's constitutional rights.
Over the weekend, the town of Winthrop posted a statement online citing potential costs and legal liability as factors in its decision to drop the application. Wells is the only town in Maine that's joined the program, which gives police officers the authority to enforce certain aspects of federal immigration law. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Ari Snyder.
A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration policy prohibiting the use of the X marker on passports, as well as updates to sex designations. Esther Pratt Kiley has more.
U.S. District Court Judge Julia Kopic temporarily blocked the Trump administration from adopting a policy that only recognizes people by their sex at birth. On Friday, the judge ordered the State Department to issue passports to 6 of 7 transgender and non-binary plaintiffs while their lawsuit plays out in court. The judge's decision was based on findings that the policy is likely unconstitutional and violates the Administrative Procedure Act. The ACLU says it plans to seek a class certification to extend the preliminary injunction to the broader group of individuals affected by the State Department policy. Maine is one of 22 states that allow a person to select X as their gender marker or change their sex designation on state IDs like driver's licenses, which remains state law. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Esther Pratt Kiley.
A bipartisan group of state lawmakers has introduced legislation to change the state's paid medical and family leave law. Some trade and business groups say the changes will make the program more sustainable for employers. The current law establishes a weekly benefit of up to 90% of an employee's wages, depending on how much that person earns. Maine State Chamber of Commerce President Patrick Woodcock says the new bill would establish an across-the-board weekly benefit of 65% of an employee's wage.
That improves the solvency and encourages workforce participation.
The bill reduces the financial penalty for businesses that do not comply with the law, capping the maximum fine at $50 for each affected employee. The legislature's labor committee is scheduled to take public testimony on the bill on Wednesday. Many Maine fishermen are applauding a new executive order from President Trump, which calls on the federal government to identify and roll back regulations that are overly burdensome to the commercial fishing industry. Ben Martens with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association says the order signals that the Trump administration wants to listen to commercial harvesters and involve them in decision-making and research.
There are a lot of regulations that, you could take a scalpel to, right? We can clean things up. There's a piling up of regulations that takes place over time. And so I think it needs to be done carefully.
Martens says he's encouraged that the Agriculture and Commerce Departments would work together to create stronger U.S. markets for domestically harvested seafood. But he stressed that any deregulation must be done with a healthy NOAA, which has already lost staff and faces more workforce and budget cuts. Cooper Flagg officially declared for the NBA draft in a post on social media today. A Newport, Maine native, Flagg was named the 2025 Associated Press National Player of the Year and is anticipated by many to be the number one overall pick in the 2025 NBA draft. He averaged almost 20 points per game in his freshman season at Duke and helped lead the team to a 35-4 record and a Final Four appearance in the NCAA tournament. The NBA lottery set for next month will determine which team gets the first chance to select Flagg in the June draft. In the first few months of his administration, President Donald Trump has cut the Department of Education workforce in half and signed an executive order to eliminate it altogether. He's also targeted the state of Maine by putting a freeze on funding for schools, citing DEI programs, transgender athletes, and student protests. As Maddie Smith reports, the uncertainties around the fate of the department and its mission are affecting all levels of the state's education system.
Colby Matolci is 14 years old, a student at Oxford Hills Middle School, and loves the movie Jurassic Park. Colby has Down syndrome, autism, PTSD, and a few other diagnoses. His mom, Aranka Matolci, says he rarely attends school in person because of incidents of hitting or being aggressive with school staff that cause him to be suspended. And she says the scale of recent changes within the education system are even more dramatic than those seen during the COVID pandemic.
This is different. This is the scaffolding of the only things that have met critical needs.
She says when Colby is in school, he spends his time there alone with an EdTech because he can't be safe in the classroom with other students. EdTechs are paid partially through federal funding, and Matolci fears what will happen if more cuts are made to classroom support mechanisms.
The prospect of what's coming, I mean, if it's already been that bad, I mean, already in the context of him being in school, he's lost a permanent tooth in his classroom. He's been lost by staff. This is without staff and funding being cut.
Overall, K through 12 public school budgets are split between allocations from the state and local property taxes. But federal funding is used to fill in the gaps for special education, rural schools, and school nutrition. In fiscal year 2024, the Maine Department of Education received more than $275 million in federal funds. That represents about 10% of school district budgets across the state.
There's a strong likelihood that 10% understates the actual dollar volume.
Ezekiel Kimball, interim dean at the University of Maine College of Education and Human Development, says some federal money also goes to grants that local districts receive or nonprofit agencies for work done to support schools. And he fears that the loss of staffers at DOE who can help solve problems at the local level will be felt.
The people that someone in the state of Maine, a local school, a local school district, the State Department of Education might have emailed 2 days ago might not be there tomorrow.
The prospect of significant funding cuts comes as many school boards are in the process of drafting their budgets for the coming year. Some are planning for an expected loss in funding. Portland, Maine's largest school district, is anticipating a downward budget adjustment of $1 million. But the effects of these changes at the federal level will be felt at all levels of the system, says Jason Judd, executive director of the nonprofit Educate Maine.
And that comes in the form of everything from career and technical education to higher education to preschool support and expansion to working with our low-income students and families from some of our most rural districts.
Judd says he's concerned that staffing cuts at DOE could affect processing times for FAFSA, the federal application for student aid that is due each spring.
And if there's a slowdown in processing time based on a shortage of staff and those letters come in late, more families may choose to not send their student on to higher education.
Anything that has an impact on the ability of a student attending one of our universities is worrisome.
University of Maine System Chancellor Daniel Malloy says the system received $225 million in federal funding last year, mostly in the form of direct financial student aid. Malloy says research funding is also a major concern. In early February, the Trump administration effectively shut down the independent research arm within the federal DOE and has also attempted to revoke more than $60 million of UMaine's USDA funding.
We've been led to believe that monies would be available. We're going to fight those fights, but do it in a respectful way and try not to make ourselves any more of a target than we have to be.
Back in South Paris, parent Aranka Matolci says she's worried about the future of her son's education.
That's my biggest concern, is that there will not be any regulatory body that oversees the laws that ensure my child's rights and the rights of all people with disabilities to free and appropriate education.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Smith.
Some Mainers still remember a time when you could walk the shore of a rocky cove at low tide and find plentiful clutches of blue mussels. After an ocean heat wave in the Gulf of Maine about 10 years ago, though, the mussels started to disappear. By one estimate, mussels have declined 60% on the coast between Cape Cod and Canada since the 1970s. Researchers are now trying to assess how many mussels are left and where they are. And mussel farmers are adjusting to a diminishing resource they thought would be around forever. Peter McGuire reports as part of our Earth Day series with the New England News Collaborative.
Carissa Morin says she hears all the time from people shocked by the sudden loss of wild mussels.
The mussel beds have been either disappearing or they haven't been able to find mussels where they usually have been able to find them for generations.
But what if mussels didn't actually vanish? What if they just moved further offshore in order to survive? On the gravelly shore of Mackworth Island in Casco Bay, Morin and a team from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute are on the hunt. She motions to a cove where researchers are using a marine drone to map out a large bed of mussels hidden below the water.
We are still finding them in these subtidal or deeper water areas, and these are locations that people wouldn't normally see unless you're there exactly at the right time on the right date within a two-hour window.
Vast beds of blue mussels used to be common in the intertidal zone, the area between high and low tides. Today, they're mostly gone, and no one is 100% sure why. Overfishing, ocean acidification, and predation could all contribute. But a common theory is that water temperatures in the Gulf of Maine skyrocketed about a decade ago, and the green crab population exploded. Without harsh winters to keep them in check, the invasive crabs devoured everything in their path.
Green crabs love mussels. They're easily picked off. They don't have to burrow for them because they're, you know, they're sitting there on a rock or on some hard substrate.
Brian Beale, a professor at the University of Maine at Machias, says commercial landings of blue mussels were cut in half in the last 10 years. And Maine's mussel farms were also affected. The bivalves used to be so abundant that farmers could do well just from growing and harvesting wild mussels that settled on ropes suspended in the water. Beale says those times are long past.
When you compare today's settlement on those ropes to just 10 years ago, it's almost night and day.
Now the industry needs help from operations such as the Downeast Institute, where Beale and others are growing mussel larvae in a lab and shipping them to farms such as Bangs Island Mussels on the Portland waterfront.
So this is the remote settlement facility.
Matthew Moretti points to shelves holding huge plastic tubs tucked into a corner of a warehouse. They're connected to a complicated water and feeding system for baby mussels, which are destined for his farms in nearby Casco Bay.
Here we take hatchery-reared mussel larvae, put it into tanks, and allow it to settle onto ropes that we then bring out to the farm.
Moretti says there was no need for this process or all that equipment when he started the farm 15 years ago. But he says he's doing what's needed to ensure his business can survive.
We are working pretty hard towards a future where we could, if we needed to, replace all of our wild mussel seed capture with hatchery mussel seed instead.
Back on Mackworth Island, Aaron Whitman from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute is guiding a marine drone that's on a search for submerged mussel beds. He says a better mapping of wild mussels could help farmers like Moretti plan for the future as the climate warms.
I feel like it's a win-win for mussel farms to know where these mussel beds are, and so they can harvest them, but they can also have an idea of where those mussel seeds are going while they're doing their harvesting.
And Whitman says the project will also gauge how the local ecosystem is doing overall. If it's doing well, he says, you'll see mussels. And if not, you won't see them. Or at least, not as many. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, how your garden can contribute to a sustainable environment. I'm Nicole Ogrisco. Thanks for listening.